I'm Nala Ayed. Welcome to Ideas. Like painters and artists, mathematicians take the same deep pleasure in what they do. They admire the intricate and delicate harmonies of the numbers and the forms. They marvel when a new discovery opens up an unexpected vista. And the joy they feel has a remarkably aesthetic character, even though none of the senses are involved. Henri Poincaré, possibly the greatest mathematician of the 19th century, wrote those words. It's as though Poincaré had gazed more than a century into the future and seen Mariam Mirzakhani.
Finally, we have our fourth Fields medalist, Mariam Mirzakhani, for her outstanding contributions to the dynamics and geometry of Riemann surfaces and their moduli spaces.
Mariam Mirzakhani won the Fields Medal, the Nobel Prize of Mathematics, for her work when she was 37 years old. She was the first woman, the first Iranian ever to do so.
It's very creative to do mathematics, at least at the level of somebody like Mariam.
But just 3 years after catapulting to the world stage, Mariam Mirzakhani died, leaving many to wonder what she would have wondered and gone on to achieve. Mariam was a gifted mathematician, so gifted, even she couldn't grasp it fully. Most of us will never understand Mariam's achievements in hyperbolic geometry, but we can catch a glimpse of who she was and what her work tells us, not only about math, but about the world.
There was something romantic about the whole story, maybe not about her mathematics, but about the fact that she had come from not one of the top countries that are typically named for mathematics. And in fact, she was the first Fields Medal from Iran. In some sense, it was a Cinderella story.
This is the story of Mariam, as told by her friends and colleagues and Mariam herself from interviews she gave shortly after winning the Fields Medal. We're calling this episode The Gift of Mariam Mirzakhani.
It's very creative to do mathematics, at least at the level of somebody like Mariam. It's an extremely creative thing. It's hard to explain how it's creative, but nobody is telling you what to do. It's not like you have some example in a textbook and you've just got to copy it and put different numbers in. It's nothing like that. My name's Caroline Series, and I'm an emeritus professor from Warwick University in England. And at the moment, I'm retired, but I'm actually the president of the London Mathematical Society, which is really the UK Mathematical Society. The Fields Medal is like the big prize in mathematics, and it's awarded to somebody who's under 40, and they award them once every 4 years at the International Congress of Mathematicians, which happens somewhere in the world, and they award four medals. So it was just enormously symbolic to think that a woman could work at that level. And you have to be quite young. You have to have done your work, you know, in your 20s and 30s, which is, of course, difficult if you're raising a family. And you have to work at the absolutely highest level to win this. Particularly, I think, younger women just found this really enormously moving, actually. If you go back historically, of course, like 200 years ago, women were more or less forbidden from doing it. There were a few women who managed to do it, but there are all sorts of stories about women who wanted to study mathematics and their parents wouldn't let them, and reading math books, you know, under the bedclothes by candlelight and so on. And then if you go a bit further forward in time, women might do it, but they were treated very grudgingly, and nobody really thought they would ever be able to really make anything of it or get very far with it. And that had kind of changed by, you know, the 1960s. People were beginning to change in their views, thinking that women might do it. But to have somebody actually do it at this very high level when they're quite young was really a kind of crowning achievement, to say, yes, we've really arrived, we can really do it.
So I'm going to talk about, so I changed the title a little bit here, but I'll tell you what I mean by this, by the mapping class group action. So that's the goal, to understand the mapping class group action on the space of geodesic currents.
I met Mariam Mirzakhani first as a colleague at Princeton University, where we both were at the time. She later moved away to Stanford, and I had moved to Duke University by the time she got her Fields Medal. My name is Ingrid Dobschi. I am the James B. Duke Professor of Mathematics and Electrical Engineering at Duke University. In 2014, I was president of the International Mathematical Union, which is the organization that organizes the International Congresses of Mathematicians. But it also appoints the commissions that give the IMU prizes, of which the oldest one, is the Fields Medals. And so that year was the first year that a woman was selected. And I'm just so very happy that it happened when I was president, because, well, that made it a double first, because I was the first woman president. But so I was very, very pleased that Mariam Mirzakhani was selected for a Fields Medal. And I also knew when I announced it to her, because it's the prerogative of the president to call the Fields Medalists to announce their award to them, and to ask them to also keep it quiet, because we try to keep the secret until the conference. It was hard, actually, to get to hold of her. She was the last one I managed to talk to, because she had sent emails to say that I wanted to talk to her, and she had thought, she said, that it was a hoax. So that was funny. She is, by all accounts, very modest and she really must have thought so, because she was really not trying to get in touch with me. I had to have recourse. Actually, I contacted her husband to say, could you please make it possible for me to talk to her? Because I think other people I had talked to had kind of said they hadn't quite dared to hope, but it was clear that they were very much hoping. And in her case, she really didn't. Her first reaction was, no, it's not true. So when I did get a hold of her, I explained that I knew that she was recovering from surgery and chemotherapy, and still undergoing chemotherapy for cancer, and that we would understand if she couldn't make it to the conference, that we very much hoped she could, and that we wanted to make it possible for her, if she wished to make it as easy as possible for her to be part of the celebration. Well, she was a bit nervous, because, well, this is a big, you are in this audience of 6,000 people. I mean, it was immense. And the president of the country is sitting on the dais. And we had, that was the first year that we had little movies made about the Fields Medalist. And so the names, although they had been leaked before the day before, but then so some people knew, but many of the people still didn't know. And so the movie starts, and at the start of the movie you see this coin turning around, and then it stops flipping, and you can see on the rim the name, and then there's a little movie about the Fields Medal winner.
My main interest is understanding structures you can put on a surface. There are different ways of looking at it. Either you have a surface with some additional geometric structures, or these kind of problems are related to understanding the space of such structures.
And then at the end of the movie, the winner steps up to the podium and turned around and bowed for the audience. So When her, at every name, people say, and when her name came up, it was a bigger than for the others even. And then she came up and she bowed to the audience, and she stayed there for a bit. And then she walked over to the president of Korea and got her medal and bowed again and went and took her seat.
The other questions are related to, you have a surface and you have a geometric structure and you start deforming this geometric structure and then you want to see what kind of surfaces you would get. Some of the problems, like, you know the properties of a generic surface, a random surface, but it's really hard to say something about a single given geometric structure on the surface.
It
some
was
of the work that
amazing. It was, there was such joy in the whole audience. I mean, well, there was joy for every one of the Fields medalists, but it was special. So, hyperbolic geometry. Hyperbolic geometry is it's one of the possibilities of doing what's called non-Euclidean geometry.
Well, let me start talking about geometry in general. So I'm just going to talk about two dimensions because that's a little easier.
Hyperbolic geometry really goes back to something which is called the parallel axioms. And this is basically one of the axioms in the list of axioms for geometry.
It's where in the plane, when you draw a triangle, all its angles add up to 180 degrees, where you can put six equilateral triangles.
Basically what it says is that if you have a line in the plane and if you have a point which is not on the line, so off the line, then there is exactly one parallel line which goes through this point.
So, well, you have to think about surfaces. Let me try another way.
You can have geometries in which you have that six equilateral triangles would not be sufficient to carry through the full angle, all the possible angles around one point, where you would have too many.
Okay, so there is only one line that you can draw, which is parallel to this given line, and it goes through this point.
And those become non-Euclidean geometries.
Actually, you know, honestly, I don't know knowing what hyperbolic geometry is really necessarily the best way to start on this.
My name is Evelyn Lam, and I am the co-host of the My Favorite Theorem podcast. I'm going to help you understand hyperbolic geometry. There are actually a lot of natural objects that display hyperbolic geometry. Actually, the first one I'll tell you is an unnatural object. Pringles potato chips have this saddle shape to them. The technical name is that it's a hyperbolic paraboloid, but they don't actually say that on the Pringles cans. Coral reefs often have portions of them that are hyperbolic geometry, where there's all this area crammed into a small space and it looks very frilly. The curly kale leaves are an example, or lettuce leaves, where if you were like a tiny ant that lived on this leaf of lettuce, or maybe even a microscopic organism, as you walked along, you might, if you had the brain to develop mathematics in the first place, you might have developed hyperbolic geometry as the quote-unquote real geometry of your world. So to understand hyperbolic geometry, we actually have to back up about 2,000 years and talk about Euclidean geometry. This is probably what you would have studied in school if you took geometry as one of your math classes in middle school or high school. So Euclidean geometry is plane geometry. It takes place on a flat piece of paper and was developed in around 300 BCE by Euclid of Alexandria, though we don't know very much about who the person of Euclid was. So Euclidean geometry is built on a set of axioms and postulates that kind of set up the rules for how logical deductions can occur in geometry. Is that if you have a line, we'll call that line L, and a point P that is not on that line, there's exactly one unique line through P that does not intersect L. And if you drew this on a piece of paper, you would probably believe me that that was a true statement. But mathematicians felt like this was an awfully complicated statement to have to assume as an axiom or as a postulate that's your starting point for this geometry. And so I'm eliding a lot of history here. But for about 2,000 years, at various times, mathematicians would try to see if they could prove that postulate using the other postulates rather than taking it as an assumption. In the end, it turned out that that wasn't possible. In the early, I guess, 1829 to 1832-ish, a couple of mathematicians figured out that there were ways to violate the parallel postulate and still have a consistent geometry. So one way, you know, one negation of the parallel postulate is to say between this line L and this point P, you could have multiple lines that go through P that don't intersect L. And of course, if you draw this on a piece of paper, you're going to say, no, this isn't true. But they were saying, you know, we don't want to let our visual intuition guide us. We're going to say, like, are there contradictions, real contradictions that would arise if we had multiple lines going through the point P that don't intersect L? And they discovered that you don't. And that way of negating the parallel postulate is now known as the start of hyperbolic geometry. That the other way to negate the parallel postulate is to say that there are no parallel lines through P that don't intersect L. And an example of where that would happen would be on the sphere, even the sphere we happen to live on, the planet Earth. If you think about the quote-unquote straight lines on Earth, so these are things like the equator or the lines of longitude, any two lines of longitude or any two of these great circles around the Earth intersect. You can't find non-intersecting complete straight lines on the Earth. But the hyperbolic geometry is the other direction of that. So in the early 1830s, mathematicians started to realize that this really was a valid geometry and started to explore that. Of course, there's a lot of time between the 1830s and Mariam Mirzakhani's work. There's a very long history there of people starting to explore various ways of describing hyperbolic geometry and even formalizing what exactly does it mean that this is a consistent geometry. How do we know that it's consistent? So there's a very, very long, rich history there. Those of us who ever have flown on airplanes or looked at images that NASA or other space agencies have taken from outside of the world, we can see how straight lines work or how minimal distance paths on the sphere work, how it works to live in the spherical world. Whereas with hyperbolic geometry, we don't have as visceral an understanding of that. Hyperbolic geometry really lives mostly in the imagination.
I think she was comfortable with the accomplishments. That's not what bothered her. But the accomplishments, they come with other side issues. I am Castro Raffi. I am a professor of mathematics at the University of Toronto. Mariam was known to be extremely good even before I met her in her high school. She had a reputation while she was in high school. Everybody expected her to be in the team. Yeah, she definitely lived up to it. I mean, you're immediately impressed by how quickly she learns, by how fast it is on her feet to think about things, how quickly she can solve problems. I mean, generates ideas at a very fast speed. Definitely a star of the team, I would say. The good thing about math maybe is that it's really deep. So lots of really smart people have thought about math and for many, many years. So there are lots of clever ideas and tricks and lots of really deep mathematics that exist. So if you find somebody smart, I mean, I still teach math and I come across really smart people all the time. I mean, you can always throw more math at them and teach them kind of about deeper stuff. And as much as they have hunger, you can feed them. There's a lot of math out there. So that's one of the good things about mathematics. But yeah, I mean, as an undergrad, I didn't have so much depth of knowledge myself. So it's not like I have so much more experience than she does. So, you know, it wasn't clear at all the times that I'm the teacher and I know so much more. And that's for sure. I mean, it's not like, you know, we were trying to establish ourselves as teachers. Like, you just go there, talk about math, have a good time. And, you know, I enjoy talking to her as much as, you know, I learn stuff from her as much as she learned from me, I think. As a high school student, you're not supposed to know advanced mathematics, and certainly you're not supposed to know this stuff to solve the math problems. Like, usually they have clever proofs and so on, and they don't use deeper mathematics. Sometimes they have solutions which uses deeper mathematics. But, you know, so that's not the intended solution of the problem. So, and it's not like I knew how to solve all the problems I gave them anyway. So I gave them some problems, and so she came out with a solution that she was written down and gave it to me. So I didn't talk to her, and I tried to read the solution, and I couldn't understand what's going on. I mean, I can see that it's mathematics. I can see that it has some logic to it, and it's complex analysis, and I can't follow it. So I'm like, there's no way this makes any sense. So to make sure it doesn't, I have to go read the book. learn some of the words and see some of the theorems she's referring to, and yeah, I spend a good number of hours to understand what is written here, and it turns out to be not only correct but extremely clever. Like, you know, you have to know a lot of math in a very deep way to be able to come up with a proof using advanced mathematics. So yeah, I was very impressed, and I was very surprised. How did she learn all this stuff so much that she can actually produce a proof in it? So I'm like, yeah, this looks very good. I'm very impressed, but how did you learn this complex analysis? And she was like, well, I don't completely understand what I wrote down here, but I read this other paper which was doing something similar. So I thought if they can prove this, if I change the proof a little bit, I can make it into proof of this problem. So basically she could understand, you know, that this proof is the same as that and manipulate a proof without completely understanding it. So this is, you know, that tells you how fast she can absorb stuff and how comfortable she is with abstract stuff. I mean, it's not the power everybody has. I mean, now I can kind of maybe see it more clearly that we do this all the time. Like, you don't understand some mathematics, but you know it's going to be useful to you, so you try to extract the ideas. But doing that in high school, why are you reading these papers to begin with is unclear. And how did you figure out this is the same kind of problem is unclear. And then somehow manage to rewrite a proof you don't understand in a way that still makes sense and proves what you want. Yeah, it's a complete genius. It's amazing.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, in North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on RN, and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. You can also stream us or get our podcasts on the CBC Listen app. I'm Nala Ayed. The untimely death of a genius throws us into a kind of collective mourning over the loss of possibility. What sort of dazzling feats would this person have performed, leaving us in awe? Maryam Mirzakhani died at the age of 40, just 3 years after winning the Fields Medal for her outstanding work in hyperbolic geometry. In this episode called The Gift of Maryam Mirzakhani, from CBC Radio producer Samira Moyadin, we're looking at Maryam's life, work, and legacy.
So first time I met her in the training camp of the Mathematics Olympiad. So it was in 1994. So she was definitely one of the best students in the camp, but and she was also very willing to help. Like if somebody had a question or somebody didn't understand something, she would explain it to them. She was extremely nice. Not everybody is necessarily very nice there, but she was extremely nice and very, very friendly. One little perk that you would get out of being part of the Mathematics Olympiad team is that you can enter the university without taking this big exam. So there is this big entrance exam in Iran that, you know, it's very frightening and you have to really prepare for many years. And if you happen to be part of the Mathematics Olympiad or any other Olympiad, then you can just enter the university and study the, pick the major that you want. So my name is Keivan Malai Karai. I am a mathematician and I work as a university lecturer at Jacobs University in Bremen in Germany. So we came over to Toronto. It was in happening. The competition was happening at the York University campus. So we're basically stationed there, and we would be. I think the exam also took place somewhere on the campus. It was interesting to us, I think, because it was maybe the first time that any one of us was in Northern America. So it was interesting to also discover the city of Toronto. I think she was the only woman actually who got the full score on the exam, so which is 42. So there are 6 problems, each one is 7 points, and she was the only woman for sure who got the full score on the test. And she was very well known. So, I mean, I am in touch with a number of people who I met in that competition, and she was super famous in that comp. Everybody knew her. Everybody knew that she would be a big shot. I mean, in that competition, and or Olympiad participants, then there were like small versions of celebrities, you could call them. I mean, so it was kind of a status that you would always carry with yourself for a while, at least for a few years of studying in the university as well. You would always be called Olympiadi, which means like an Olympiad participant, like a mini rock star maybe, or.
The mathematics doesn't change depending on doesn't depend on the gender of who did the mathematics. So it's not that you could judge from Mariam's papers that this was written by a woman and not from other papers, unless you knew her personal style and you already knew, you recognized the style and you knew that she was a woman. But otherwise, the mathematics is really the same.
I mean, if you gave me a paper that was by Mariam and I didn't know, I could probably have a pretty good shot at guessing, yes. It's very lucid, but on the other hand, she doesn't waste any words. So you have to think quite hard. And she does, when she comes to a bit that she has to do some calculation, say, not entirely easy calculation, but she just does it without really telling you what she did, or it's like a sleight of hand almost, and you think, gosh, how did she do that, and you have to puzzle over it. But on the other hand, it's all there. It's not, some people write in a very a way that it's, you know, really there are big gaps that you have to work up, or they put incredibly complicated notations in that you have to work and work to struggle your way through, and she's not like that. She doesn't kind of waste energy, and she goes to the point, and on every half a page there'll be some other new point that she just so cleverly turns things around. She looks at things from many different angles, so she'll approach something from 2 or 3 different angles, and each angle will tell her something, and at the end she says boom, and so something is true.
I mean, if I find a proof of some theorem, then usually I want to find a more beautiful proof. I'm not satisfied. I want to say, yeah, this is the way to say it, but is there a better way to say it? Is there? And then, of course, after you see the structure and if you see all the pieces fit together so perfectly, you definitely enjoy. It's definitely, elegance and beauty are the first words I would use to describe mathematics, for sure. And then, and her work was especially so. I mean, they were full of ideas, lots of the, yeah, I mean, what she was good at was generating lots of ideas, for sure, and she would see the connections very easily. So yeah, the proofs are just extremely beautiful.
A lot of mathematicians use those words for a lot of things that just, they're not just pages and pages of complicated, messy calculations, but you do something that is a clever trick and it just springs out at you, that's the answer. And it just hits you. So maybe you could imagine using the word elegant or beautiful for people playing chess, and somebody suddenly has a really clever move that just, you know, forces the other person into checkmate within two or three moves. And you might say, gosh, that was beautiful. And so it's a little bit like that. Somebody does something completely unexpected and very clever, and it just clinches the argument and clinches the calculation. You see the answer without having to go through pages and pages of difficult stuff. You just see it all in one thing.
To do a research career in mathematics, you have to have singular determination, because you're most of the time you're stuck and you want to find out, you want to understand, you have a hunch, you have to, and so on. You work, you try from different angles, you build a framework, and then when you succeed in understanding it, it's a fantastic feeling. It's an incredible high. You feel absolutely on top of the world. But then, of course, you want to understand it even better. And usually 2 weeks later, you feel you were such an idiot for not having seen this what you finally understood sooner, because it was there and you were just too stupid and you didn't see it. So most of the time you're not feeling happy with yourself. It's this drive to want to know, this ambition to want to do this mathematics. So you compete with the mathematics. You compete with the problem. And there, definitely, she had that ambition. There was no question.
I think it's much easier maybe to imagine what's it like being a musician. So you spend your whole life, imagine you're a concert pianist and you're going to spend your whole life practicing and playing music. Now, people can understand what comes out in the performance. They can appreciate that. But to understand what it's like spending all your waking hours doing nothing but thinking about music and practicing your music. Maybe if you're a sports person, you're a tennis player, you know, we can sit and appreciate Wimbledon, but I think most of us can't really imagine the life that would be involved in every waking moment training and practicing and so on. So if you really love doing something, it's a little bit like that. You do it because it almost obsesses you. It's like puzzles that you just want to solve, and you enjoy talking to other people about it. The problem is, with mathematics, it's harder to explain what's coming out at the end of it.
At the end of the day, we are not going to be understood. Like we know that, right? That this stuff is a bit abstract. It's not that they're difficult. It's like you have to spend some time in it to understand what's going on, right? It's kind of foreign with people because people are not used to it, so they don't know why we are doing it. And we are kind of used to that status.
I believe that it's very important to know the person behind the math always, because I think that's what helps young people decide they can be mathematicians. You can be mathematics, because it is such a cerebral thing, is a field that is incredibly more forgiving of, for instance, social awkwardness than many other fields. So it's not true that you have to be an awkward person to be a good mathematician. That's not true at all. But it is true that among successful people in mathematics, I think you find a higher percentage of awkward people than you find in many other successful fields, because we are more forgiving for it.
Being in a school where there are other kids who are interested in math, and doing it well in math is not uncool. I think that's very important, because there is a lot of peer pressure. It could be in some places, and doing math is not cool. I think that's a lot of pressure on some kids. But I had a
but I can't generalize it. It's just my own personal experience. But I think it was a very good experience, and also just to have teachers who will motivate you to then go and study things on your own. It's not about, I think it's rarely about things that you actually learn in the class. It's most about things that you are just then stay motivated and go and continue and do on your own. First of all, it takes some time before these things will make a difference. Now there are many female students, but if you go back a few decades ago, maybe things weren't the same. And so somehow, if you go back even more, you'll see that there weren't many. So the culture isn't there. There are stereotypes. I mean, there are many different factors, of course. But I think it will change after some time. But it's not something that would change in two or three or 5 years. It can take decades. But things like this change, and there are examples of these kind of changes. But it takes time.
She was fiercely private, and I don't think she wanted to starve people of seeing her or attention, but she was in this very difficult situation where, as I said, she had her health problems. She didn't want to talk about those in public. Not that she made a secret of it, but she didn't want it to be spread out all over the newspapers. She had left Iran, and her relatives were still in Iran. And she knew that certain of her life choices were not accepted by or applauded by everybody in Iran. Her husband is not Muslim, and she wasn't wearing a veil. In fact, in the announcement in newspapers in Iran, they drew a veil over her head, over a portrait that didn't have a veil originally. And there were comments about all that in all directions. And she didn't want to be part of any of those discussions. So she didn't respect this, the hunger that journalists might have for little details of her life. I don't think she was uncomfortable at the mere fact of getting the award, but she had just come out of very, very severe chemotherapy. In fact, people in that audience didn't know it, but I knew it, that she would not give her talk because she hadn't had time to prepare her talk. I mean, a talk at the ICM is something that is kind of the apotheosis of a career for many mathematicians who do it. And it's something you prepare for several months. And she just hadn't had that time. She couldn't concentrate. Moreover, a side effect of the medication was that it was depressing her. So that's another reason. So she was dealing with all that, and then she was standing in front of these 6,000 people. Most of them wouldn't know and there would be journalists. And she already had warned us that she did not want to confront journalists who would be asking her about her, what she felt, and about her state of health and so on. And so we would be shielding her from all that. So I think in those circumstances, I think that was what was causing her the discomfort, not the fact that she got the Fields Medal.
Everybody expects you to appear at different places and advocate for various causes that they care about. So this is hours and hours of distractions, right? The place you have in society keeps changing from, you know, maybe a girl in Iran who's supposed to behave a certain way to a person who's in the Olympiad and supposed to solve problems, and then to a young mathematician, then very, very quickly to a senior mathematician. And then somehow a symbol of women in the world and Muslim women, the weight of this is, like, I would say, too much for most people. She managed to compartmentalize this to a large extent. In a very impressive way. It's extremely impressive with that aspect of her life as much as with mathematics, that she could just assume the leadership role very quickly and without it getting into her head. You know what I'm saying? So she just wanted to do math and live her life.
It's true, she might have been private, but she wasn't shy. She was quite happy to talk. She was very involved in her mathematics, but she was a very approachable, pleasant person. I think she sort of accepted that she was a figurehead and allowed it. But of course, by the time that she won the Fields Medal, she was already very seriously ill. And I think that may have partly contributed to why this impression of being very private. She was a very attractive figure, in the sense of she was very modest, but always happy to talk to people. Of course, a lot of people didn't actually know her, but those who did, those who worked with her or heard her speak, you could just see how intensely she understood mathematics, and she was able to convey the joy of doing mathematics to people. It was just very inspiring to know her. I mean, because my work touches on hers, and the first time I met her, and she said, oh, yes, I want to talk to you about so-and-so, and oh, yes, that's very interesting. And then you go away feeling inspired by it. You feel sort of uplifted by her enthusiasm.
I mean, I can understand why there is this desire, at least, to sort of reconstruct, maybe, or sort of figure out, you know, what sort of person she was. This is expected, right? Because, again, I mean, this is, you know, she's something like a mathematical rock star, right? I mean, somebody who, you know, with huge accomplishments. And I think it's maybe reasonable even to wonder how she got there. And, you know, maybe there is something to learn. There is a lot to learn, basically, from her. And I think maybe part of this desire to know her is motivated by these type of questions. You know, how did she get there? What were maybe her characteristics that helped her get where she got there, where she got? And I mean, I don't think it's entirely possible even to do something like this, because, well, I mean, I think every one of us probably who met her, I think, has some kind of, has a set of memories about sort of the interactions we had with her, the kind of person she was. And, you know, I mean, maybe each one of this is like a piece of a puzzle that you have to sort of put together to get some sort of an imperfect picture of the kind of person that she was.
Well, I think it's always true, and that you get from everybody only their impressions of that person, and then only reflected through their way of communicating that. So there are already several filters there. And I think it's the challenging thing of your job to get from so many different people these different glimpses and help your audience constitute this bigger whole, or get an impression of this bigger whole. But we're always difficult to completely understand for others, because we only know one person from the inside, and you will never know Mariam from the inside.
I wasn't always very excited about math. I was more excited about reading novels, and I thought I would become a writer one day. I got excited about it maybe just as a challenge, but then I realized that it's really nice and that I enjoy it. These were quite difficult times. It was during the war. Right after the war, I had a lot of opportunities. I went to a very good middle school and then high school. And I think I was the lucky generation, because I was a teenager when things became more stable.
The way that her story is being said is a little bit scary. She was a perfect parent and a perfect mathematician and a perfect human being, and somehow managed to fit the work and life and you know, being a symbol and doing great research and everything all at once. So maybe that aspect of it is not so helpful. I mean, yeah, she walked slowly and she talked slowly and and she think, you know, I mean, she of course was a very hard worker, but it's not like, yeah, you shouldn't imagine somebody from a different universe or something. She was a person.
If you want to understand Mariam, Mariam's mathematics, then the mathematics is what you should study. But I think if you want to understand Mariam as a person, I think the mathematics is a small part. I mean, it's a part that was very important to her. I mean, she was a mathematician. She chose to be a mathematician, and she was a fantastic mathematician. But we are all much more than just one aspect of ours. I mean, she was also a really engaged mother with Tanahita, and she was extremely preoccupied with the idea that Tanahita would grow up and she wouldn't be there anymore. I mean, she actually chose, whenever she was given a choice in treatment, she would want to choose the one that gave her, even if it was harsher, but if it gave her a little bit better chance at survival, she would go for that one. Because she says, I don't want to have to tell my daughter later that if I had chosen a different treatment, maybe I would have been around instead of now having to die. So that was, I think, absolutely essential to her.
So at the moment, Mariam is the symbol, and it's completely deserved. I mean, at least she was a genius. There is no doubt about that. She did accomplish a lot of stuff in a complicated circumstances of being a woman from a Muslim country. And so, yeah, she deserves all the credit that she receives and more. So, no. I mean, you want to have a symbol, at least in this case, you have a good symbol. she's really great.
I think she would have liked inspiring people by telling them about the mathematics, by sharing her enthusiasm, by explaining, by and so on. I don't think she would have had any reluctance to do that. I think she would not have wanted people to make her into a kind of saintly figure on a pedestal. That she would have resisted, yes. I think I was in my office. Now, it was not unexpected because we knew that she'd had a relapse of her. I mean, after the chemotherapy, after the Fields Medal, she had gotten back to the department. She had started teaching again. Everything seemed fine. And then we heard that she had canceled conferences. I heard that she had a relapse. And so, with the very aggressive cancer she had, we knew that it was, I mean, cancer had won. Cancer was winning. And so it was not a surprise, but it was very, very sad. We reach out, women reached out to each other to comfort. I mean, have you heard? I mean, it's so sad. There was something romantic about the whole story, maybe not about her mathematics, but about the fact that she had come from an not one of the top countries that are typically named for mathematics. And in fact, she was the first Fields Medal from Iran. In some sense, it was a Cinderella story. She not quite, because she had been recognized as a mathematical, very talented young woman early on. But yes, in a field where there are not many mathematicians, and then a young mother, and then dying tragically after having received the Stopp Award, I think there was a lot of feeling. Many people felt touched. The whole women mathematical community felt, well, I think the whole mathematical community, but the women especially felt very, very moved.
I saw her in January, so around 4 or 5 months before she passed. Yeah, I went to her house. We had dinner. I mean, she was doing her duties as a faculty member, as a mathematician, so she was still in the editor of some journals that she was working on, and she was keeping up with that. But at that time already the treatment was taking most of her time. I mean, she had to fly to different cities to get different drugs and so on. But yeah, no, the last year wasn't easy at all. She passed on my birthday. Yeah, that's pretty horrible. So I remember the day always.
Many of the things that she did are still being worked on, and people are developing the consequences. So she has a very substantial mathematical legacy, even though it's, you know, she didn't have that many years to do it in.
Well, the mathematicians are not so focused on the story. They are focused on the math. And the math is being read still, is being digested, is being used all the time. The math is not lost.
Over the last few years, there have been groups of women mathematicians forming in many different countries around the world, one of which was in Iran. So there is an international body which coordinates these international congresses and is also, it's a bit like the United Nations for mathematics. And in 2014, for the first time, there was a woman president of this International Mathematical Union. And during the time she was president, we formed a committee for women mathematicians to kind of coordinate all these different groups all around the world. And one of the groups that formed was a group in Iran, and they approached us to suggest that there should be a day for women in mathematics and that it should be Mariam's birthday. So that's how it came about. And then it was kind of put to... So in 2018, when there was a gathering of women mathematicians from all around the world in conjunction with the International Congress, there was a discussion and it was agreed that there should be this day.
Hi everyone, I'm Ha. I'm from Vietnam and I'm a mathematician.
Sono Elisabetta Strickland dall'Italia e sono una matematica.
Mi nombre es Janet Chacali, soy de la República de Panamá y soy matemática.
Tends to a constant and it's bounded by this linear function as long as L1 and Lm tend to infinity. And that's important and make it a little bit more complicated because it's not true. If you want to approximate this by a linear function, you have to be careful because there are lots of big x's and y's. Okay, maybe I'll stop here. My time's up.
On Ideas, you've been listening to The Gift of Mariam Mirzakhani from CBC Radio producer Samira Moyadin. For more about Mariam's life and work, you can visit our website at cbc.ca/ideas, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and our weekly newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can stream our program on the CBC Listen app. Special thanks to Mohsen Namju for allowing us to use his performance of the Persian folk song, Ay Sariban. Thank you also to the Simons Foundation, Stanford University, and the International Mathematical Union for their interviews with Mariam Mirzakhani. This episode was produced by Nahid Mustafa. Lisa Ayuso is the web producer for Ideas. Technical production, Danielle Duval. Nikola Lukšić is the senior producer, executive producer Greg Kelly, and I'm Nala Ayed.